Well, he's known as the crypto hunter. John Rhodes back with us after about 5 years, and we're going to be talking about reptilians, underground bases, and having some fun right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. John Rhodes, also known as the crypto hunter, back with us, one of America's most outspoken and controversial researchers. He's known around the world for his pioneering work researching reports of reptilian humanoid contacts and his out-of-the-box perspective regarding UFOs, alien encounters, the hollow earth, secret government technologies, and subsurface facilities. John has been a featured speaker at national and international UFO conferences, and his research discoveries have served as platforms for the beliefs of many other notable speakers and authors. He also acts as a professional consultant for literary and broadcast industry projects dealing with UFO-related subjects. Welcome back, John Rhodes. How have you been, my friend?
I've been doing great. How have you been?
I'm doing super as well. I miss you. It's been 5 years since you've been on the program.
It seems impossible to believe that it's been that long, actually. I've missed speaking with you and Tom, of course.
And then with COVID shutting down a lot of live events, it's been a tough time, John, hasn't it?
It's been a tough time. I feel that we're in historic times, however, and that the times that we live in right now will be regarded by our children or our grandchildren and their grandchildren as being just as important as the first American Revolution, because out of this, I think we're going to be coming out America 2.0.
Lots of new listeners since 5 years ago, John. Tell us a little bit more about you. How'd you get involved in all this?
Well, years ago, I was looking into areas of science, wondering what the pursuits would be in that area for myself. And I had come out of a career as an actor out of New York City, and I had a car accident, and it left me with short-term memory loss issues. And, of course, I couldn't hit the stage with that being a problem of mine. So I had to challenge myself to facing other things to do in life. And one of them was getting into an area of science. And when I started to look towards doing that, I, at the same time, encountered people who were having visitations or sightings of creatures that were not human. They were upright and looking and intelligent. And this kind of got my attention, and I kind of took the foot. And in the course of doing so, I've worn a lot of professional hats. I've taken jobs in areas simply and moved there simply because I've heard of things going on in the area. I took a local job. I would get in at some sort of position around the town, which would allow me access to information as well as eyewitness testimony. And I would look into mysteries around that area, and then I would move on to the next one.
As the crypto hunter, John, what have you learned over the years that you didn't know before?
What I've really learned is that we really have a limited scope of the view of reality given to us in order to keep us in a confined perception so that we just keep buying products and being automatons and not really realizing that true freedom is kind of enjoying what's really around us on Earth, much of which has been hidden from us. And the people who are in control will continue to try and hide that from us for many years to come. And I feel that that's kind of an unfair thing to do. After all, we all ended up here somehow. And to me, mysteries and especially wondrous things that are of nature are of special interest and very entertaining to me.
John, I want to talk about reptilians this half, and at the other half of this hour, we'll talk about some of these underground bases. Then we'll take calls with you in our second hour. Are you still investigating, though, cattle mutilations? Because you jumped into that in a big way years ago.
No, I'm not investigating the cattle mutilations anymore. A number of years ago, I had contact with the gentleman who appeared with Oprah Winfrey on her television show, in which they made comments about meat. And, of course, this started a big court battle between the meat industry and Oprah Winfrey. And after this battle, the gentleman shared with me the fact that he was informed that President Bush had come through and made sure that anybody that was making the American people insecure about their food chain supply would be considered a terrorist. And now, of course, we're living in times in which that's kind of an accusation. It's kind of hard to come from under because of once you're accused, you know, the headlines are much louder than the follow-up.
Right. You're guilty just on the accusation.
Right. Right. And, you know, what we really found in doing that whole thing was that it was all MRSA-related environmental research. I started using Google Maps and the measuring and direction and azimuth tool in the measuring tool to actually find out that what was happening is there was a linear trajectory of placement of the carcasses of the animals, and it was directing my attention towards an environmental issue. And, for example, the 2006 cattle mutilation that you and I have spoken about, and we had Sheriff Tom Cook on the air with us, that particular carcass, when you extended out in lines from the nearest lake and channels and canals to a line to the animal and this trajectory, straighten out the trajectory, the following year, two cows were left mutilated. And one was deposited directly on the line that was drawn from the canal to the 2006 mutilation and trajectory out. One was dropped there, and then when I went there and looked at it, I could actually look at the nearest nuclear silo, and I was thinking, well, maybe it has to do with the nuclear silo over there because there's a lot of them. So I got on Google Maps again and extended a line from that point out through to the nuclear silo, and then about a mile and a half past that, direct, straight, dead on, the line fell on the water tower to a chicken and pig farm. And this is where I think that we kind of found that the pig feces and the chicken urine and stuff like that was all being mixed together as a fertilizer in water and then sprayed with like fire engine hoses high up into the air over their crops and stuff. And this may have actually drifted downstream into water supplies and on crops. And I think what we're looking at is a long-term environmental study that somebody is doing. And they're leaving the evidence behind because they want to make sure that we have the intelligence to perhaps look and study the animal like they did instead of just writing it off afterward. After all, they could have taken that animal and, you know, disintegrated. They could have, you know, interred it or dropped it off in the mountains and nobody would have known any difference. But they're taking precautions to preserve the animals as best as possible by keeping predators away, spraying something on them and keeping predators away. So that we say, hey, here's a phenomenon to be investigated. And I've worked with I work with sheriff's departments in the United States, even one in Georgia, in which when they find the cows, they'll most likely find them with their heads pointed towards a ravine or something. And usually there's something environmental going on, something getting in the water supply. And the one in 2006, by the way, I found out that later on, not only did they get violations for the pig farm up there, get violations for groundwater supply issues, but also and well issues, but also there was a spill of pig feces into the lake that feeds the water supply that goes downtown to the nearest town of Valier and then beyond. So this is an environmental issue, and I think that's why people out there in the media like to write it off as something that's having to do with UFOs and scary kind of creatures and stuff, because they find it easily dismissed. Whereas if you say, hey, there might be an environmental issue attached to this, now all they do is see Superfund site dollar signs in their eyes and they don't want to deal with it.
Now, what's going on with reptilian humanoids? This is something that you've investigated in a big way.
You know that we're describing something that people have seen and reported, and what's going on with them currently? Is that what you're asking me?
Yes.
Currently, they're kind of sitting back, I think, taking a look at what's happening to us socially and our new alignment, our international alignments that are going to come out of it. I believe personally that we're in a timeline. We happen to just be beings that fell into a long timeline of people who come lived on Earth, in which we're lucky enough to be here, because they're going to be realigning global politics, I think maybe even to meet the demands of extraterrestrial contact. Keep in mind, extraterrestrials may not want to deal with different nations and different negotiations of political interests at stake once they arrive here. They may want just one voice. And if they say we want one voice to represent your planet, then what do we do?
That's a good point.
I think, and I think that's why the U.S. Navy is starting to release the photos. We're talking about craft descending from 80,000 to ground level in less than a second, which is about 50,000 miles an hour. So I think the government's getting close to really kind of saying, well, if we're in a social unrest and we're going to reinvent the world and America, that we might as well release the information about extraterrestrials as well, because otherwise it may cause a social unrest in the future. So why not have everything happen at the same time?
These reptilians, are people still seeing these entities?
Yes, they are. Now it's kind of hard to actually discern which ones are real reports coming in, which ones are fictionalized, and which ones are just imagined or dreamt or anything like that, because
and they all happen, all three, don't they?
Well, they do, and the discussion has gotten so vast. It's in the early stages of discovering this, when I did, you know, it was easy because there were so few people reporting it, and so you knew that they didn't have any kind of social contamination, meaning the discussion went on the internet and they read it somewhere, because the internet was just getting going at this point. And there wasn't anybody on the internet ever to have the website talking about the reptilian humanoids. I kept searching and searching. That's why I just created the reptoids.com, because I needed a place for people to come to delineate or to be able to share what was happening. And at that point, I thought, well, if this is really occurring, there's dangers too, because for me and others, because if this is all real, which it appears to be, then I know that I'm being watched, and anybody I'm being used as possibly as an attractant to call the, you know, to call everybody out to get them on lists and everything like that. I get a little paranoid, because I know that this, you know, borders along national security, because we're talking about an intelligent, advanced being.
What are people seeing in South Carolina, Bishopville?
Oh, back in 1989, a boy by the name of Christopher Davis was stopped his car and was changing a tire when a large bipedal reptilian humanoid creature came running out of the farm near Beanfield and started darting towards his car. So he started his car and drove off. And as he did, it jumped on top of his car and reached down for his window. And he swerved the vehicle and threw it off. And it took him 2 hours of crying with his parents before they finally called Sheriff Liston Truesdale.
He had a nervous breakdown practically, didn't he?
Yeah, and remember our friend Liston Truesdale, who I know you've spoken to. So he was the one to interview him, and he put him through a lie detector test, and Christopher Davis passed the lie detector test. Then there were other sightings that occurred, and before you knew it, Bishopville, South Carolina grew into kind of a mad circus with the news down there and people reporting on the ABC Nightly News talking about a lizard man running around. And of course, there were the goof-offs that tried to make money off it and get on camera and dress up as in costume and everything like that. Like I said, it was a media circus. But Liston said to me that if he was facing the danger of people going kind of overboard and shooting people with their dogs and their hunting guns and stuff like that. And there were enough cases down there to say that something is living in that swamp area, and it's not normal. There's been an entire family even that saw it. And at times it appears without any clothing, and other times it seems to have a large wrapping or chest and waist area of large hair, which may be an animal pelt used as to keep warm or as disguise. Because if these things are living in remote areas and sometimes come in contact, are they smart enough to try and stay away from us, even to the point of camouflage?
What nut job, though, John, would want to dress up in a costume down there when everybody down there practically has a gun or a shotgun?
Well, you know, you're right. I mean, it's insane, isn't it? But, you know, the fact is that they did, Liston did have to talk to an Air Force sergeant who was found with some sort of a lizard man suit. who claimed he was the one that has been running around doing this. But Liston said, no, no, no. He said, I might be a Southern sheriff, but, you know, I was trained at the FBI Guantanamo, you know, Quantico FBI Training Center. He says, I'm not stupid. He says, this guy was lying. So you had an Air Force guy trying to fake it, that he was actually the one doing it.
Do they live underground, these creatures?
Yeah, for the most part, they appear to be, because while we have a lot of satellites at this point covering the surface of the Earth, historically, they've had connections underground. And I believe that, you know, through Earth's history, we have had them evolved underground as well, on Earth, as well as perhaps off Earth. But, you know, the nature of a reptile is to hide under a rock. It is the safest place. It's only us idiot humans that seem to live on the surface where everything damaging happens. Civilizations get wiped out. You know, wars happen. Disease happens. It's more controlled underground in the environment. So none of that really is an issue, really, I think.
Have people been threatened by these humanoids?
No. I believe that some people are perhaps having parts of their reptilian brain awaken, and they might have nighttime encounters with projected visions from their own imagination. And it's not to say they're crazy, because, you know, there's certain psychedelic stimulants that can cause things like this. And when they do, they face something that's like a hidden, deeper side of themselves in which they're scared of. And they immediately feel fear. You know, it's the old imagery of everybody has a dragon within them, but you have to learn to tame it. And if you feel like you can't, it becomes your demon.
I mean, because these descriptions are sort of like what people describe Satan as, aren't they?
Well, yes. The more ancient Jewish texts in which the Genesis stories were derived from actually speak of the serpent in the Garden of Eden as having the arms and legs of a man, in which upon it, on its legs, it would rear up and run through the garden. And so this is a more detailed description than what we get in the King James Version, not a translation, by the way, his version
right.
of the Bible. They simplified it, because I think they've been through time trying to hide the fact that we are not the only occupants of this planet. One of these days, they are going to find out we have been living side by side with another elder species that has a reptilian physiology to them. And we have called them by different names. Physically, you know, we call them reptilian humanoids, or as I like to call them, as reptoids. It sounds more definitive. They have been called the Djinn by our friend Rosemary Ellen Guiley and others, because they have the effects of maybe going astral and affecting electronics or moving through things. When you put all this together and you look through ancient history, you got to look at what people are happening now. And it's like the Ouroboros, the snake devouring its own tail. These stories seem to come from the past and continue into the future. And really, I think what we need to do right now is kind of look at the subject matter. Instead of ridiculing it, look at the science behind it and not the sensationalism. And we don't need to project our ills on other creatures and when they're not here to defend themselves, because you know what? There's a lot that we do that's bad.
Absolutely. John, when we come back, let's talk about some of these underground bases that you've done some work about. Next on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take your calls next hour with John Rhodes as we talk about reptilians, underground bases, UFOs as well. So jump aboard. We'll be doing that next hour. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you with the crypto hunter, John Rhodes. John, you're one of the leading authorities on underground bases. How did you get interested in that area?
Oh, I think just by being even just a resident in Nevada. Back in Las Vegas, we had close proximity to Area 51 and the rest of the test site. And I think that my curiosity was, you know, how could you have so many employees doing work like that on the surface when satellites have the ability to penetrate through almost anything It must be impossible that, and there must be a truth to the element that most everything is underground. And I started talking to people, and I actually spoke with one engineer that had been there at Area 51, and he had told me one of the most amazing things that he had ever seen was their underground runway, and that had an open hatch, which, like aircraft, would come down and land within through a 300 by 300 foot hatch, I think he said, and it was a arrestor hook. So they had Navy pilots in the earliest times, and they were landing aircraft in there. He said one of the most amazing things is you would see such a large expanse of area not having any central columns or supports, because as an engineer, you're just not used to that. It's like being in a stadium. You wonder, you know, the grandeur of it all. How can those ceilings be so tall? How could everything? It's just amazing. And then I've heard other reports from individuals saying that they've even seen things like an underground swimming pool that's stainless steel, solid piece, Olympic size, or a lake in which you can row boats out on, an underground lake. And these are the kind of things that some of these underground bases actually have. It's not all just gray concrete and metal pipes running overhead. And that's what they like us to believe it is. It's much more luxurious than that.
How cavernous are they?
Well, some of them can be quite cavernous. We know that during underground explosions, and they sometimes use nuclear weapons, underground nuclear explosives, to hollow out a chamber. And these chambers, by some of these yields during Operation Plowshare, which was the peaceful use of atomic weapons for engineering purposes, they had would take some of these bombs and they would leave cavities underground. They were as big as the Empire State Building. And a slurry was used in these things to wash it out, and then they would remove the slurry so the open cavity of things like that could be used to actually build these underground bases. And like the one that's in outside of Dulce, you know, because it wasn't a number of years ago, I think 1967, December 10th, 1967, in which a 29-kiloton nuclear bomb was thrown down a shaft into a region of shale to see if they could frack the shale to release natural gas. If you can imagine, using a nuclear bomb for fracking. And they threw the bomb down the chute. And I've read the engineers' reports talking about how the bomb, the bottom of the shaft filled with water and started boiling the nuke. And it carried on for a couple of weeks, I think. And they finally got it under control. And when they blew it, of course, it vented, releasing, gases into the atmosphere, which contained radioactive particles. Now, upwind from that, you have the town of Dulce. So now you see that there's a potential for things to have been investigated, long-term environmental effects that the government would want to see on the wildlife and everything through generations of their stock in the Dulce area. And that's why we had Benowitz and those guys in Dulce were in experiencing cadmium ablations. And that was the start of the beginning of the onset of the real weird things that came out of the Dulce area.
What have witnesses described these underground caverns and bases to be looking like, John?
They've described them as various ways. They've talked about how large that they are. And then they said that most everything they have in there are large open expanses, a lot of buildings, the vertical high-speed magnetic rail launch vehicles also seem to be a part of how these things come in and leave. So in other words, and I'm a little off the center, but I want to make this point. A lot of people see a flash of light at Area 51, and all of a sudden some things shoot up into the sky. When you have full afterburners going on an aircraft and you have a magnetic rail launch rail pointed vertically, and it was underground, all you would see is a blast of light and something shooting into the sky, which meets exactly the eyewitness reports when they see things that have happened over there. And that's because most of our military now has moved underground.
For what, safety purposes?
for safety purposes. If you think of the underground environment like a large aircraft carrier with all the complements, housing, dining, exercise, like a hair salon, recreation, a commissary, a full liquor bar. They've reported tunnels with roads leading through them to the exits, usually at something like an airport hangar. So when things are brought in on aircraft, they can go into a hangar, and then the items don't go anywhere and they don't come out. The airplane comes out empty. So they may have actual connections directly into airports, as well as warehouses and also guarded entries, you know, regular guarded entries.
Have any of these reptilians been seen at any of these underground bases?
In Dulce, they were reported being at Dulce, participating in some of the experiments, the medical experiments that were taking place there. And now people have reported them associated with different underground areas, and including up near the Yosemite National Park. That's what kind of drew my attention up there. And it's entirely possible that that they could be living just around the corner. I'll give you an example. Where the reptilian humanoids were seen up here is on a river that feeds into the Yosemite National Park. But in the ancient, in the old days, the Mariposa Battalion that was up here, made of the guys that were chasing fighting the Indian Wars, were constantly chasing Indians in towards the park, and every time they'd go in there, they would disappear, and they could never find out where they disappeared. Well, in 1854, an article was written saying that it originated out of Mariposa, the Mariposa Chronicle, and it appeared in the New York Times as well as all over the nation, and they said it had a sense of romance to it because it seemed too impossible to be true, but guys from the battalion were trying to find out where the Indians were going, and they had located a cavern opening in which they entered and found a pathway that led through the Sierra Mountains towards Mono Lake, and it took them 4 days to travel it. During that time, they encountered two Indian medicine men who were angered by their presence, but then again became friendly to them and told them to stay on the path and how to leave and don't get off the path, otherwise they would die. They said the cavern was large enough to have its own mountains and its own rivers. And halfway through, they found a huge mound of bones of human remains. And it could possibly be the remains of some of the original Indians that were occupying the Yosemite Valley up near, and also up near Mono Lake. In ancient news reports, they were called the Tall White Indians because they had the appearance of a Caucasian. And some of the early newspaper reports said that the valley was not just a normal valley. It was beautiful and splendorous, to be sure, but they said that the Indian village had a central structure in which the chief lived and operated, and it was three tiers high with terraced verandas, and it was in the shape of a pyramid and covered with flowers.
Wow.
Some of this stuff we've never heard before.
Has anybody reported, John, seeing UFOs coming in and out of these underground bases?
Yes. Like up here, we have the flight activity going on. You have to look for what might be nearby. In the case of the Sierra Mountain Range, we're due west from Area 51, and usually those exotic aircraft like to play cat and mouse games with the engineers from Silicon Valley, so they fly their exotic aircraft in and out of the valleys in the Sierras and then up and down the Golden Chain Highway, and they're playing cat and mouse games with some of the most advanced electronics trying to detect them entering the area. And this is how our military operates. So if you're looking at for an underground base and stuff like that, you just need to pretty much pay attention to like Wednesday and Thursdays, because Fridays they're debriefing and Mondays they're briefing, so the flight times are usually on those 2 days. It's usually, if anybody were looking, it would be after the sun goes down, but before the moon comes up. And if it's a moonless night, then they like to fly during that time as well. So that increases your chances of being able to spot something.
Are these bases there, John, primarily for safety purposes in case something happens, some worldwide calamity? Or are they there for military purposes? What do you think they're there for?
Well, they're there for all those purposes. I personally believe that catastrophic situations occur on the surface of the Earth far more often than we're led to believe, because, you know, that makes us think in short term. But they want us to think long term with our investments and our product and our life, and not think in terms of catastrophism. And they prepared for that. There was a book written by Edward Zuckerman called The Day After World War III. And in it, he had said that General Altoonin, the former Soviet Union civil defense chief, reportedly justified the expenditures and efforts of the Soviets to build more protective systems. And he said there, and I'm going to quote this, "In the United States, modern underground federal control centers which provide protection from nuclear weapons have been established. About 232,000 protective structures with a capacity for over 200 million people were recorded back in 1975. This is what the general was telling the Kremlin.
Wow.
Okay, so that's 1975. Wow. He's claiming 200 million people. Look,
that was two-thirds of the population of the United States at the time.
Right. So, you know, you have to wonder exactly what's going on underground there. Is that why every hammer costs like $50 million? You know, because of expenses, you know, on these military projects, is how much money has been going into these dark projects. We're not allowed to know those figures. They're not even made public. So they may be actually prepared, or they may already have a civilization underground going in which only the elite gets sucked down and filtered into that civilization as if nothing ever happened, while the rest of us are left out here to the terrors that rain down on the planet.
Have you, John, went looking for these bases?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Here's I'll give you an example. I was along the coastline here and along Southern California. And I'm not going to say the exact location, but it was known that there were Nike missile sites along the cliff edges. And these were near homes and things. And a friend of mine and I went down there and we started looking around. Well, these were supposedly decommissioned. But then when we're walking around, they had the cables coming out of the earth, like a foot and a half cable that contained, I don't know, 500 wires. And all of them were clipped and cut. And it was exposed on the surface. And I said to my friend, "Oh, look, they made that really obvious. Like, we're supposed to see that this has all been cut." And then we walk around, and then I say, "Oh, here's the entrance." And it was an old door, and it had the grills on it, the type that have the fan, the little vents coming down, the little louvers. And, you know, our phones are pretty good. They fit in areas where before you couldn't get a camera.
Right.
I reached in there, and I went clip, and I took a picture, and I went, you know, what's really strange is this was decommissioned like how long ago, but yet the picnic table that's here for people to take a smoking break, it's plastic and it's new.
That's interesting.
Okay, right. And so I went back.
Little subtleties, huh?
Right. And, you know, they're saying a lot of these things are decommissioned and not being used, whereas actually they are being used. And then, of course, you know, you turn around, there's a sign, and it looks up, and right above it is a camera. The sign says, federally protected area, you know, you cannot be in this area. So it's like, okay, and I said to my friend, "Oh, don't look now, there's a camera right there." And he, of course, looked up, and I said, "There you go, snap." I said, "They've got you on film." That's one case in which you can actually go to a place to look around, and they go through efforts to try and conceal it. But you have to look for the subtle clues around it in order to determine if there's been recent activity or if there's nothing there at all. And the other thing is that, you know, there are places you could go. For example, I've mentioned before on like the UFO hunters, I encountered the Men in Black, the two physical guys and their black vehicle, with a friend of mine outside the Grand Canyon Caverns off Route 66. And they seemed to be very sensitive about that area for some reason. I mean, I was wondering if they occupied other caverns that could have been, you know, created in the same system nearby or towards the park. But in that case, they said, you know, "Hello, how are you?"
Mm-hmm.
And then they mentioned a couple of personal things about me that I would wonder, how would somebody like you know? And then they go, what are you doing here?
Well, they did their homework on you, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, they were trying to impress upon me that, okay, this is serious. We know stuff about you of a personal nature. And then they said, what are you doing out here? And I said, well, my friend stayed in the car. He refused to get out when he saw these guys. He said, no, you brought me out here, so you're going to have to deal with it. So he stayed in the car. So I got out. One leaned against the tire and the hood, and the other one came over and spoke to me. And he said, what are you doing out here? I said, we're just looking around. And he goes, you could fall down out there. You could fall down in a cave or a pit. Nobody would ever find you again. So you better be careful.
How many bases do you think are out there, underground bases?
Oh, like if Al Toonen's saying, what, 232,000? Okay, just take a stretch of imagination. If you take just a fraction of, say 23,000, that's a huge amount of underground bases. You got to remember, a lot of World War One was fought in underground bases. And World War II, but they never talked about it.
Bunkers.
Yeah, they've been trying to keep our attention off it, thinking only about surface warfare.
Hold on for a second, John. We're at the top of the hour. We're going to come back and take phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.